Welcome to the Right Turn Radio Podcast. I'm John Cohan.
And I'm Abby Dean.
And you're listening to New England's foremost addiction and mental health program.
Tonight we're going to talk about pain.
Okay.
And pain treatment.
Okay.
And addiction. But also the mental health effects of pain.
Sure. Of being in pain.
Yes.
Dealing with chronic pain.
Chronic, acute too.
But, okay.
And how do you treat the pain? How do you treat pain? What's the best way to do it? Mm-hmm. Medication that could become addictive with alternative, you know, what's the best way to treat pain? And how do you treat someone with addiction so
sure.
that they don't, if they're in pain, so that they don't become addicted to this medication?
Yes. And, you know, you often hear about people who are in recovery. It's a huge fear that they might get injured or have to undergo surgery and be prescribed these medications where their body doesn't know the difference, but they might need them for pain. So great topic.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about it. And what we know is it's a huge problem because tonight we have an expert with us. We have two guests joining us. The first one is Judy Foreman. She's a nationally syndicated medical journalist and author of the book A Nation in Pain, Healing Our Biggest Health Problem. And it's an amazing book.
Awesome book.
It is cover to cover, full of incredible amounts of research.
Yes.
And she's with us tonight. She was a staff writer at the Boston Globe, so most of you have heard of her, and is now a freelance health and science columnist for several publications, including the Los Angeles Times, the Dallas Morning News. She's in the studio with us.
Hi, Judy. Welcome.
Thank you.
I've heard of the Boston Globe.
Yes.
Yeah. We're also going to be joined via telephone by Janice Kaufman. Janice is Vice President of Addiction Treatment Services for North Charles Foundation Incorporated, the Director of Addictions Consultation for the Department of Psychiatry at Cambridge Health Alliance, and Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. I've also heard of Harvard. She's worked with addictive disorders for more than 40 years in direct treatment. She's worked through program development, teaching, local and national policy initiatives, just tons of stuff. And she's joining us on the phone tonight.
Welcome, Jan.
Thank you for having me.
Hi, Jan. Welcome to Right Turn Radio.
Thank you.
So we're going to start by talking to Judy about... Judy, how did you get interested in pain?
Of all things.
That's right.
The hard way. And by the way, hi, Jan. Jan was kind enough to let me come visit her addiction treatment center in Somerville. I got interested, which is sort of a mild word for it, when I had excruciating neck pain. The cause wasn't clear initially, but it turned out I had a bunch of things wrong with my neck. My vertebrae were sliding over each other. I had bone spurs. I had degenerative discs. And it really hurt. On a scale of 0 to 10, it was about a 20. I mean,
wow.
The pain was excruciating. Even now, you know, here we're sitting in the studio with earphones on. At the time, I had a talk radio show. And just having the weight of these little earphones, I mean, professional earphones, but they weren't 10 pounds. By the end of the show, I would be in agony. So, you know, I was a science writer at the Globe and a medical writer, and I kept thinking, you know, why on earth would this pain be there? I mean, pain, you know, if you burn your hand in the fire, you learn not to put your hand back in the fire. But this kind of chronic pain is completely non-adaptive. Mm. And so in addition to being curious about my own case, I became curious about how common it was and what caused it. And that set me on the path for this book.
Was it provoked by something, or was this just like, you know, a normal process of aging in your case?
Probably the latter. Mm-hmm. Although I had just
She's
gotten...
really only 20, guys.
Yeah, I'm really only 20. I just looked...
Luck can happen in 20 years.
Me too.
Is it? Yeah, we all are.
That's right.
But, I mean, there was no real explanation,
sure.
except that I did have a laptop computer and I had to scrunch over it. So my neck was in a really bad position a lot. But that was true for a lot of other people I knew, and that didn't happen to them. So I really have no idea.
Wow.
So, I mean, and you, what kind of treatment did you get for it?
Bad.
If any.
No, well, I got a lot, actually. I went to the people who specialize in this are called physiatrists, which are basically rehabilitation doctors. And I went to a couple of them and then finally found a really great team at New England Baptist. And this is not a paid political announcement. They were really terrific. I did take opioids. They were somewhat helpful, not slam dunk. I did acupuncture. I did massage. I did not do chiropractic. I did not do marijuana. But what really, I think, got me better was an intensive exercise and physical therapy program. And we can go into that later if you want.
Sure.
But
yeah.
That really turned it around.
So you wrote this book to try to, like, I mean... So
why did I write this book?
Why did you write this book? Because it's great.
Well, thank you. I wrote this book partly because I am a science writer, and the physiology of pain, believe it or not, is actually really interesting, because anything that involves the nervous system and the brain is really interesting. But also there was a sense of outrage that I felt because there's so many people in pain. There are an estimated 100 million Americans in pain, which means more people are suffering from chronic pain than cancer, heart disease, diabetes, and AIDS all put together. And yet the government the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, spends less than 1% of its massive budget on basic pain research. And medical schools barely teach about pain. There was a big study from Johns Hopkins in 2011, and they looked at 117 medical schools around the country and found that the median number of hours spent teaching would-be docs about pain was 9. That's
wow.
Out of 4 years. Even veterinary students get more pain education than that.
What kind of stuff are they teaching them about pain?
Not much.
In 9
and
hours.
To the extent that they are, they're basically telling doctors to be very wary of opioids.
Wow. Okay.
So in terms of non-opioid treatment for pain or what's actually going on with pain, doctors really don't know. And surveys of doctors show that they feel really unprepared to deal with pain patients. And yet pain is the main reason people go to doctors. So what really prompted this book was this sense of a huge mismatch between the number of people suffering and what the government and medical schools are doing to help.
Wow.
Well, and the reason I wanted Jan on is because a few times in the book you mention her, and she talks about the relationship, and I'm going to ask Jan to talk about it, but she talks about addiction and opiates and, you know, and I thought it was really important. So, Jan, can you tell us how you got into what you're interested in?
Yeah. I first got involved in working with patients with addictive disorders. And the first population that I worked with people who had opiate addiction. And I got particularly interested because, you know, I came from a generation, I was in college in the late 60s and 70s, and there was a lot of experimentation with drugs, and some people moved on and went on with their lives. Other people got stuck. And I found that particularly curious as to why some did and some just couldn't, you know, move on. So that was my initial interest in addiction, and by chance got connected at Cambridge Hospital and took a job and worked in a methadone treatment program. So that was my first exposure, and I haven't left. I was totally fascinated with the patients. I was intrigued by their illness. I was impressed by the strength and creativeness of the patients who I treated. And, you know, the neurobiology, there were so many levels to this that it was totally fascinating. And to me, it was a crossover between psychiatry and medicine, which I loved. The pain issue, I think, was over time for me. Particularly working with patients in methadone treatment, HIV, people with hepatitis, chronic pain, diabetes, neuropathic pain, and the stigma associated with patients with addictive disorder and their inability to get pain treatment in a way that felt humane and really attended to their problems. And so they became a population in addition to the general population that got worse treatment. In fact, got no access to treatment. So, you know, those were some of the major reasons. I also spent about 18 years working at Brigham and Women's Hospital running an addiction psychiatry service. And so you saw people come into the hospital with acute pain, chronic pain, active addictive disorders, patients in recovery, but were faced with having to take pain medications for their acute, either surgical procedures or because they had chronic pain and the kinds of issues that came up for them. I mean, I could go on. I worked with medical professionals with addictive disorders and some of the problems that they raised. So my interest just evolved over time. And, you know, I was delighted to have had a chance to talk with Judy because she's done really an incredibly balanced job in her book, A Nation in Pain. And we had a really good time talking about this as she was developing it.
Well, I mean, when I read the book, I think the important thing is people in pain are treated like suspects, no matter what. I mean, and I've known that from me. I've known that from everybody. And instead of it being like you two on opposite ends of the spectrum, you know, addiction is a physical illness. People should be screened for it, but people shouldn't be treated as bad people because they're in pain.
Right.
And that's what I feel like over and over. Maybe just, it seems to me, especially women, they go into treatment and they, you know, hi, I have this pain. It's this. No, it's that. Or, you know, or it's in your head. And it's just, it's really a shame because just because you can't see it, addiction, you can't see pain, doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
Yeah, and that they coexist, right, too.
And when we come back from our break, we're going to talk about how you both see treatment of pain that works. And Jan, you're going to address specifically with people with addictions. And we'll be right back after this break.
So Judy, let me ask you, if someone, you know, just a typical patient goes to a provider, a doctor, and they report pain, they're dealing with some sort of acute or chronic pain, what's the process? Like, how are they assessed? How are they treated? What's typical from your research?
Well, first of all, there's a big difference between acute pain and chronic pain, and we should probably make that distinction. Officially, chronic pain is defined as pain that lasts more than 3 to 6 months.
So let's take, like, but your pain that you were struggling with.
My pain was chronic. It was about a year. With acute pain, like after surgery or a car accident or you break your arm or something, that's pretty straightforward, and generally the medical system does a pretty good job of that. But chronic pain is a totally different animal. It's not just acute pain that doesn't go away. What happens is the nervous system kind of revs up. Mm-hmm. And just like, you know, when you learn French or you learn to play the piano, the more you practice, the better you get. Same thing happens. The nervous system learns to process pain ever more efficiently, which it gets better and better at it, which is, of course, worse and worse for the person. So the nervous system cranks up and pain becomes its own disease. And that is a concept that is really important and central to the whole pain field. But a lot of doctors don't really know that. The other thing that most doctors don't know is that cells from the immune system called glial cells, G-L-I-A-L, also help with this cranking up process. So it's much more complicated than doctors ever learn in medical school, in 9 hours of medical school. I wanted to make a distinction before we go on. There's a big difference between addiction and physical dependence. Addiction is a primary chronic neurobiological condition characterized by impaired control over drug use, compulsive use, craving, even committing crimes to get the drug. Physical dependence is very different. It's a state of adaptation to the drug, somewhat analogous, but not totally to a diabetic needing insulin. So if you're my doc and you put me on opioids, in a few weeks, I will become dependent, meaning my body has adapted to having my little receptors in my nervous system full of opioids, which means that if I stop cold turkey, I will go through withdrawal. I'll have flu-like symptoms. I'll feel terrible. You can overcome this without too much trouble in most cases by tapering off very slowly, although some people have a hard time, even if they're not addicted, merely, in quotes, dependent. But there's an important distinction because if you take opioids for any period of time, there's a 100% chance, it's a certainty that you will become dependent. But there's not a 100% certainty, far from it, that you will become addicted. The figures for actual rates of addiction are all over the place. They range from less than 1% or less than 2% to about 30%. No one really knows, and it depends on your family history. So there are important distinctions to be made, as I'm sure Jan can verify.
Sure. So if I go to a doctor and he shows me that little chart, you know, with the pain scale, a smiley face at one end, a sad face at the other, I mean, how do they assess this, you know, this potentiality that somebody might be coming in seeking medication compared to somebody who just might, you know,
they might
really
be telling the truth.
It.
Yeah. Sure. Basically, it's really hard because it is all based on self-report. And the assumption far too often, especially in emergency rooms, if someone says they're in pain, the assumption by many, many doctors and nurses is that the person is just a drug seeker. And it's a horrible, we basically have two colliding epidemics. It's a horrible situation. We have a genuine drug abuse epidemic, and we have an epidemic of poorly treated chronic pain. And the suspicion basically falls on pain patients. They are first perceived to be potential abusers and usually only secondarily as pain patients. So it's a major problem.
So Jan, can you tell us a little about your reaction to this part of the conversation?
Well, I mean, I think that Judy made some very important clarifications between dependence and addiction, that they are two different phenomena. From my perspective, I think about it a couple of ways. When a patient comes in and they report that they're in pain, I believe them. I respect their report. We may have different ideas about what would be the best way to treat their pain, but one of the things that patients struggle with, and providers as well, is that there's this whole business of, is it real pain or not? And my response to that is, pain is whatever the patient tells me it is. And so it is real to them. And there are many components to pain, and people express pain in a lot of different ways. And so I think it's just really important. My first point is to sort of say we need to respect the patient's report of pain, and if they say they're in pain, they're in pain. Patients with addictive disorders are very much treated like they are drug-seeking. I think oftentimes people who request pain medications in general are treated like they're drug-seeking. But if you happen to have an addictive disorder, if you happen to be on methadone maintenance treatment, for example, or buprenorphine treatment for an active addictive disorder, and you happen to have pain, which a significant percentage of the population have, you are seen as drug-seeking. But there are some things that we have to really pay attention to. If somebody has an addictive disorder or maybe in remission and has had an active addictive disorder in the past and is now in recovery, we need to respect that as well. So we need to be mindful that they have pain, and we also have to respect the complexities of an addictive disorder, which can really trick the mind in the presence of getting opiates, that everything is under control and there's not going to be a problem. So, you know, there are a lot of ways in which I think about it in terms of making sure that we're keeping both the disorders on the plate and we're paying attention to one as we're addressing the other. I can get into some of the ways in which I think that works as well as what we know works today.
So
that would
Jan,
be helpful.
Jan, we have a caller. We have Paul. Paul, tell what's your question?
Good evening. Yeah, here's my question. It's a two-part question. Number one, in the history of mankind, I don't know if it was the Germans, but in terms of different ethnic groups or cultures, what was used for pain? You know, whether it was alcohol, whether it was morphine, heroin, whatever may be in the case. I think that will be interesting for people who are listening. And then number two, the problem we're having now, whether someone's trying to treat a patient, it's much like the criminal justice system, which isn't working. Probation officers, police officers, et cetera, they almost assume everybody's lying now. Because people in the cities, they say, people don't keep it real anymore. It's almost expected that you can lie or you can stretch the truth, and we're gonna play with it. And
well, thanks, Paul. I think that is one of the major concerns, and that's how everybody is treated, is about the lying. And I know we only have a little bit with you, Jan, so can you kind of address that?
Well, I mean, I think that if somebody, you know, if we're talking about patients with addictive disorders, we know that, you know, lying, I don't always like the word lying, but, you know, sort of representing a person's, you know, perceived truth, is part of an active addictive disorder. And that patients will do whatever they need to do in order to get what they need. So that could be true if they're trying to seek pain medication for chronic pain, and they are trying everything they can to get what they perceive they need, you know, for that treatment. So, you know, I think that we have to keep in mind that patients will tell us what they need to tell us in order to get what they need.
Right.
And people with active addictive disorder, that's part of the illness.
Right.
And I need to pay attention to that and understand that on the one hand. On the other hand, you know, I also need to look a little deeper to find out, you know, what is their pain complaint and what are the ways in which we can help them hopefully get on a road where we can get real about what's really going on for them and put together a approach that would be safe for both treating pain and also keeping honest with their addiction.
We're here with two wonderful experts on pain, different aspects of it. We're here with Judy Foreman, who wrote a book, A Nation in Pain, which everybody should read, and you'll know a lot more about pain than you ever thought you wanted to know. But
absolutely.
You do.
Yeah.
No, but you want to know it. It's so fascinating. And Janet Kaufman, who's from North Charles Foundation. And one of the things we've been talking about, you know, opiates, you know, opiates.
Medicine. Yeah.
And there must be other ways of treating pain, and I would guess both people here would know about them. And Judy, can you tell us some of the other options of ways of treating people in pain?
Yeah.
Yes, there are a lot, some more effective than others, not surprisingly. There are some sort of traditional Western treatments, you know, like surgery, killing nerves, various techniques for sort of interventional techniques in medicine. They're somewhat effective. I mean, in the right cases for the right candidate patients, they work really well. But in general, particularly with surgery for back problems, the data suggests people should not leap into surgery. I mean, when it's the answer, it's a pretty good answer, but often it's not the answer, and there's a lot of they call it failed back syndrome. I mean, the person's back hasn't failed. The doctors have really failed the person. But there are a lot of other things. I have a whole chapter, interestingly, in the book on marijuana for pain, and I got very interested going to these pain conferences because marijuana seems to be roughly as effective as opioids for pain, and it is way less addictive. And even the federal government, which has a very confused policy about drugs in general, concedes that there are no deaths from marijuana alone. And the reason is marijuana, unlike opioids, does not cause respiratory depression. So you don't die from marijuana. I mean, if you drink and take marijuana and drive and get in a car crash, that's a different scenario. But there was recently a study in the last couple of weeks showing that states that had legalized marijuana were reporting far fewer opioid-related deaths. Hmm. So no one knows exactly why. There's some data that marijuana plus opioids has a synergistic effect, and so you can reduce the quantity of opioids you're taking. And if people are taking it for pain, maybe they're getting the relief they need from marijuana, which is a way safer drug than opioids.
Sure.
So Jan, if I walked into your office and I had, you know, and I had was in recovery from, you know, my heroin addiction, how would you work with me if I was, you know, I was back on, I had a back problem and I was starting to take painkillers again?
This is for someone who's in recovery?
Yeah.
Or even if it's on methadone.
Yeah. Well, being on methadone,
it is recovery.
In my mind, is in recovery.
Sure.
And I think
that's
a very important point to make.
I think so too.
I mean, I think that I would say, look, we're dealing with two disorders that we have to keep in mind. I think what I would say to the patient is being having addiction very actively a part of your treatment plan or an addiction approach is very important. So it's important to involve a sponsor, a family member, to be going to counseling during that time so that you can, you know, what we would say, you know, keep it honest. Be able to deal with any cravings that if you're on medication, that medication may bring for you, and to put safety factors in place for you to help you monitor your use of pain medication. I think the first thing I would say is it's very, very important to be honest with your pain treating physician.
Yeah.
That you have an addictive disorder and that you are on methadone treatment, and that hopefully the collaboration of the pain treatment along with your addiction treatment would be something that would be dealt with together. And so communication back and forth between the treaters is really important, involving supports, active supports in your life, so that if there are cravings that get triggered, there are ways to deal with it. That would hopefully deter you from misusing medications or, you know, doing what one does when their addiction becomes activated.
So I'm hearing the patient.
There are a number of things. And also, I think, you know, to try things that are not opioid medications or maybe non-medication interventions as the first course of treatment, as opposed to medications being the first course. And for many people with addictive disorders, they're so used to this automatic thinking that it has to be a medication, that nothing else will work, that's part of the education process for the patient as well.
Well, I think that's interesting because I think that's our culture, is that the medication is the answer.
Boring to say, but that gets back to, in part, to the reimbursement system for healthcare. Because if a doctor has 10 minutes to see you, 15 minutes, and you're in pain and your story is complicated, they may think they should prescribe opioids. They don't have time to get into your divorce and your mother dying and all these other things that contribute to your distress. And they often don't recommend other things. In my mind, you know, opioid should be the last remedy, not the first. Exercise is tremendously effective for pain. In fact,
yep.
I think if there's anything that's a magic bullet for many kinds of pain, not all, exercise and physical activity is number one. And yet, for people in pain, there's this huge fear. It's called kinesiophobia. The idea is that of course, it has a big name. But, you know, if you move, you will do tissue damage. You will make your pain worse.
You're going to make it worse.
And
yeah.
That is more likely than not to be not true.
Mm-hmm.
But people are often depressed because of their pain and or depressed to start with. And that also gets in the way of them exercising. And as they sit around, they get fat. And that also gets in the way of exercising. And so, I mean, I'm really so convinced of the exercise that I have a whole chapter on that. And while many things in medicine, there's studies one way, studies the other way, virtually all the studies on exercise and pain point to it being extremely beneficial.
Mm-hmm.
There are other things, too, that are free or close to free. Meditation is not going to get your pain from a 10 down to a 6 all by itself, but it can help. It might knock it down a notch or two. And once you learn how to do it, that's also free. It's simple. It's not easy to do, but people learn it. And there's a lot of data from brain scanning technology showing that people who meditate are less likely to get chronic pain in the first place, and also that it can mitigate the pain. Again, this does not mean that the pain is in your head or that your wrong thinking or your attitude or something is causing your pain, but it is a trick that you can do to help cope with the pain. And there's other things. There's acupuncture. There's massage. There's a whole slew of things that can help to some degree. And if you add them all together, you can make a significant dent, not a cure necessarily, but a significant dent in the pain.
So I'd like to just comment on what you're saying about depression, Judy, if I could.
Sure.
Because I think that, you know, when people are in pain, they get depressed.
That's right.
I mean, it's
depressing.
A normal reaction to your life being so disrupted.
That's
being
right.
In pain. And so, and if you're depressed and you're not doing the things that, you know, make you happy, then it becomes a vicious cycle. And so figuring out ways to keep people moving so that they're not sitting and feeling horrible about themselves is really important. So it's depression, it's anxiety. They come hand in hand for people who have pain. And for people who have active addictive disorders, this is another co-occurring issue that comes up for them.
And basically, you have to treat both the pain and the depression.
Well, and I want to thank you, Jan, for being on. And you know, the talking about communication and supports and honesty is, respecting people's pain and respecting their addiction as well. We're going to take a break now, and we'll be back, and we're going to talk about what makes a difference.
Judy, I have a question for you.
Sure.
Regarding your book, there's a lot of interesting stuff in there about gender and pain or genetics and pain. Can you discuss those roles a little bit?
I certainly can. Why don't we start with genetics? Because I think a lot of people, there's a huge stigma to addiction, there's a huge stigma to pain too.
Oh, I know.
And actually, research on rodents and human twin studies shows that 40 to 50% of a person's susceptibility to pain and sensitivity to chronic pain is genetic, is inherited.
That's huge.
It's huge. And it's interesting scientifically, but I think it's also really great because it kind of takes the stigma off. You know, I mean, it does run in families. And it's another way to think about the pain that you have not being your own fault because people get blamed so much. There's very interesting research on this. I talked to one woman who has a mutation in a certain gene, and she is in terrible pain, like, you know, a 20 on a scale of 10, every single minute of her life. And three members of her family have committed suicide.
Wow.
I should mention that the suicide risk for people in chronic pain is twice that of people not in pain. And a different mutation in the same gene causes an inability to feel pain. And I talked to the family of a young girl in Georgia who had that. And that sounds like it might be great, but it's not, because she's gotten herself severely burned and broken a bone.
And didn't even know it.
So the interesting thing from a scientific point of view is this is really leading researchers on a really productive path in terms of figuring out the genes that make pain better or worse, that protect you or put you at risk of pain. And I think that's very, very promising, as well as extremely interesting.
Well, one of the things that was interesting is the discussion of gender, because women always say that if men could have babies,
there'd be no babies.
Right, because they can't tolerate pain.
That might be true, actually.
But actually, it's not true.
It's not true, yes.
Women, up until puberty, boys and girls have roughly the same amount of pain. Then starting at puberty, teenage girls and women get a lot more pain. And we're not talking about pain that only women can get, like childbirth or PMS or breast cancer pain or something like that. These are pain conditions that can strike anybody: irritable bowel, fibromyalgia. Those things are disproportionately a problem for women. And no one is quite sure why, but it's a very real, totally documented phenomenon. There was a big study a couple of years ago in 10 countries with 85,000 people, and 45% of women were reporting some kind of chronic pain, and only about 31% of men. So it's a significant difference. One weird little sidelight to this is that despite this huge difference, most of the basic pain research involving animals, rats and mice, is done in male rats, which makes no sense. In fact, it makes my blood boil. The National Institutes of Health is trying to rectify this and make scientists include female rats as well as males in the study, and to the point of recommending that journals not publish scientific papers unless the researchers do this.
Sure. And they believe that the rats might have the same genetic predisposition that we do? Like the female rats might feel pain differently than male rats?
That is probably also true.
Okay.
But there turns out to be no scientific justification for studying only male rats. It used to be thought that, females are too complicated. They get their periods. They get babies. Therefore, we won't study them. But that rationale has been totally blown apart.
Okay. Yes. Well, they're half the population.
They are half the population. And they get more than half the pain.
Right.
So that's crazy. There was a very interesting study in Italy a few years ago that, to my knowledge, has not been replicated, but they looked at transgender people, and the ones who went from male to female and started taking estrogen started reporting more pain, and the ones that went from female to male and started taking testosterone started reporting less pain. So in general, there seems to be a big hormonal influence on pain, and you know, women often get migraines around their period, and certain pain conditions for women get worse when they're pregnant. Some conditions get better when they're pregnant. Some get worse at menopause. Some get better at menopause. The estrogen part is really complicated, but it's very important. The gender thing is very, very, very important, and some researchers now think it's so important that we'll end up with pink pills for women and blue pills for men.
So I wanted, we have just a few more minutes, and I just wanted you, you know, you did, you've been doing this research, you're continuing to do research. What have you taken away? What are your recommendations that change?
Oh, my goodness.
I know. In 2 minutes.
Well, if I really came away believing that the failure to adequately treat pain is akin to torture, because it really is a horrendous situation for people, that we are, in a sense, overregulating opioids in our attempt to prevent addiction, we are really making it much tougher for pain patients. And a lot of people, even in hospice care, about a third of the people are still dying in pain. I was at Sloan Kettering not long ago, and one of the doctors was talking about a patient who was dying from cancer in terrible pain, and the patient didn't want to take opioids because of the stigma. I mean, we've got some crazy thinking going on with this. I also think a lot of the non-drug approaches to pain management are huge, and we should put a lot more effort into that. And doctors should educate themselves about this. But in the meantime, you know, don't wait for the doctors. I mean, pain patients can do a lot. There are some wonderful pain organizations on the web, and in reality, U.S. Pain Foundation and others, the American Chronic Pain Association. There is help out there for people in pain, but you have to go get it.
Nice.
Well, thank you for being with us, Judy. You can get Judy's book. We know it's available at the Booksmith because we were there today. And on Amazon, it's called A Nation in Pain. And it's
an incredible book.
It's a lot of research, and you will know a lot more. And we have a few other things we want to talk about. The annual Harvard Medical School Cambridge series called Treating the Addictions. It's every year. It's the best minds talking about the best ways to treat addictions. It's March 6th and 7th this year.
You've been listening to the Right Turn Radio podcast. Check us out at right-turn.org. I'm John Cohan.
And I'm Abby Dean. Remember, be safe and ask for help.